Greetings, welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on this Sunday, December 4th, 2005. Today, our guest is going to be a leading journalist who has a brand new book out, Beat to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Out. Christina Borgeson will be joining us to discuss her book of interviews with some of the leading journalists in the United States, discussing the state of contemporary journalism. So join me today in Media Matters, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Since buying biased news coverage has worked so well at home, the U.S. government's been pulling the same shenanigans in Iraq. Since at least June, a private public relations firm called the Lincoln Group has been paying Iraqi newspapers anywhere between $50 and $1,500 to run good news stories about the ongoing military occupation. It also cultivated a cadre of Iraqi journalists, which were placed on monthly retainer salaries to report positively about U.S. activity in the country. Some of the Iraqi newspapers identified the paid-for stories, but many others did not, and in no case was the actual origin of the stories revealed. In addition, PR funds have been used to buy at least one Iraqi newspaper and one radio station, both of which claim to be independent, but they too won't disclose who really owns them. The Lincoln Group has a multi-year, multi-million dollar contract with the Pentagon to provide PR services in Iraq and elsewhere. Like many other sections of the armed forces, psychological operations have been downsized and outsourced to private contractors. The Lincoln Group's contracts with the Pentagon may net the firm as much as $100 million if their propaganda mongering is successful. One real worry, though, is whether any of these pseudo-stories made it out of Iraq and were disseminated back in the United States. It's not uncommon for Western journalists to pick up story ideas from Iraqi media, although such propaganda blowback has not been confirmed. A deeper look at the Lincoln Group reveals more interesting details. Its most public executive is Christian Bailey. He's heavily invested in Iraqi real estate. He also co-chaired the presence of LEAD 21, a business lobbying group for young executives at the 2004 Republican National Convention in New York. Some of the Lincoln Group's business in Iraq has also been subcontracted to global PR giant Burson Marsteller, more specifically to a subunit of that company run by Charles Black Jr. Black was once the political director of the Republican National Committee, and he's also worked closely on the campaigns of Presidents Reagan and both Bushes, serving as chief campaign spokesman for Bush Sr. in 1992.
On November 29th, the Senate Commerce Committee held a public forum on the subject of indecency on radio and television. Although the Federal Communications Commission has the power to restrict and punish the airing of indecent content on radio and TV stations, it does not have the same power over subscription-based television services, such as cable and satellite channels. However, more than 80% of Americans now get their television via cable and satellite, so there's a growing gap between the amount of sex and violence to be found on the tube and the FCC's ability to do anything about it. FCC Chairman Kevin Martin thinks viewers should have the flexibility to pick and choose the channels they receive. Instead of selling channel packages, Martin wants cable and satellite companies to offer customers the option of buying only those channels they want to watch.
Cable TV's pricing structure is a bit like being told you want Newsweek and Sports Illustrated, fine, but you got to pay us $50 a month and also take delivery of Cosmo, Maxim, Easy Riders, and Guns and Ammo.
If the industry is not willing to pursue this option, Martin says the government should consider expanding the FCC's anti-indecency enforcement authority to cover subscription-based TV. Although the FCC hasn't issued any fines for broadcast indecency in 2005, after doling out a record amount in 2004, agency watchers expect a slew of rulings to come down before the year is through.
Sony BMG's decision to seed many of its music CDs with copy protection software that made people's computers vulnerable to hackers may end up costing the conglomerate quite a pretty penny. At least 7 class action lawsuits have already been filed against Sony BMG over the rootkit-infected CDs. Now, the Attorney General of the state of Texas has joined the fray, claiming the company's copy protection measures actually qualify as spyware, and peddling spyware is illegal in Texas. That suit seeks $100,000 per copy protected disc sold in the state. And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. Media mergers and acquisitions are taking place at a furious pace this year. According to investment bank research, there's been about $52 billion worth of mergers across multiple media sectors through the first three quarters of 2005. That's an increase in transaction activity of more than 125% over a year ago. The most quickly consolidating sectors include magazine and newspaper publishing, internet properties, and database information services. Yet media stocks are not performing well this year. The prices of shares in the largest four companies, Disney, News Corporation, Time Warner, and Viacom, are down more than 11% on average from a year ago. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today is Christina Borgeson, the editor of a brand new book, Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Out, just published in November by Prometheus Books. Previously, Borgeson edited the book Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, which won the National Press Club's Arthur Rouse Award for Press Criticism and the 2005 Independent Publisher Book Award, the IPPI. In current events, she's won an Emmy and a Murrow Award winner as an investigative reporter who has worked for both CBS and CNN. We taped this show a few days before going on air so I could be on location doing some research for future shows in New York this weekend. So sit back, relax, let us do the talking, and enjoy the show. Christina Borgeson, thank you for joining us on Media Matters.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, we had you on before, as you may recall, when Into the Buzzsaw first came out, and now you've got yet another book about the state of contemporary U.S. journalism. And maybe to put this book into context, why don't you talk about Into the Buzzsaw, that book briefly, what that was about, and how that led to Feet to the Fire.
Into the Buzzsaw is a series of essays written by leading investigative reporters and authors, each one telling their personal story about the problems that they encountered. Most of these people work for mainstream media or traditional media, as people put it, and they talked about the problems that they had trying to get out important investigative stories. Either problems with their news outfits or pressure from the outside. And I thought it was an important thing to do after I had a problem trying to report on the demise of the TWA 800 at CBS and ran into what I call the buzzsaw, which is you think you're doing the right thing and doing your job, and all of a sudden somebody out there decides that the information you have is too sensitive or shouldn't get out or whatever, and you run into all kinds of problems. So the stories in Into the Buzzsaw were essentially firsthand accounts of people who had this experience. And, of course, as you know, you're the final chapter, putting everything in a larger historic perspective. So this book came out of Buzzsaw in that I thought that the best way to really look at what media does well and what it doesn't do well, during a time is within the crucible of a time of crisis. And boy, you couldn't come across a bigger crisis than 9/11 and post 9/11 in the Iraq War. And what I decided to do was again go and talk to the journalists who were the best known that would agree to talk to me, and also those who were writing on issues that were germane to post-9/11 reporting. and which is pre-war reporting and then war reporting. And indeed, the book, you know, turned out to be pretty multidimensional in that it really shows how the media's arena of power, meaning the people in media's arena of power interact with the political arena of power, where the limitations are, how the system sort of downplays or marginalizes tough reporting that asks critical questions when the political arena of power doesn't want those questions asked or that tough reporting getting out or getting traction. And it also shows who was doing the best job and why. So that essentially is how this book came out of Buzzsaw.
Christina Borgeson, is one of the hypotheses of this book or assumptions or conclusions that the situation facing working journalists in U.S. newsrooms today covering political journalism and important stories more difficult than it was a generation ago, or is this a problem that's existed all along?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, yes, everything has evolved. Certainly, it is much, much harder now for the press to really get out good and timely information on the activities of the arena of power. And I'm talking about, you know, right now, I'm really mostly the executive branch of government. And Walter Pincus of the Washington Post is the one who pointed out to me that the reason that is because ever since the Reagan era, and he blames Mike Deaver for this, basically the executive branch has taken control of getting information to the public in a sense in a PR mode, as opposed to, and also to Congress, by the way. And basically what that means is that, you know, policy is decided outside of public view, and oftentimes too without in with this administration, you know, policy. Ron Suskind talks about how it's unprecedented with this administration. The policy is basically decided by a small group of people, and we all know who they are. And you know, Rice, Rove, Cheney, etc. And then whatever comes out of the decision making, that small decision making process, is packaged and sent out as PR to Congress and to the American public. And if you couple that with unprecedented secrecy and also a really very fast reacting and brutal suppression machine if information that they don't want out does get out, you have a pretty well-controlled flow of information from, you know, the nation's power center, which is the executive branch right now, and the rest of the country.
Christina Borgeson, our guest today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Borgeson is the editor of the brand new book, Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Up, published in November by Prometheus Books. This is a book where Borgeson interviews 21 leading journalists in the United States. Many names you'll be familiar with. We'll be talking about them during the show today. You know, clearly you frame it around 9/11, the media after 9/11. And what, in general, if I can ask, Christina Borgeson, is your assessment of the caliber of our press coverage of the war on terror in the United States? How good a job have our news media done of sort of bringing this to our attention and covering it well? And to the extent they haven't covered it well, what are some of the stories you think that have gone into the buzzsaw that should have gotten attention that haven't?
Well, the entire, entire pre-war era, for example, when the White House was creating all these ad hoc groups to get information, bad intelligence from Ahmed Chalabi, and to package it and then put it out as to sell the Iraq War. I mean, this is a story that is now getting legs, which should have had legs back then. It was being covered by Knight Ridder, and Knight Ridder figures very prominently in this book because they did do a very good job of that. But still, I don't think the reporting on what happened on 9/11 has really been done.
What do you mean by that?
Oh my God, there's so many serious questions about what really happened, and so many dots to be connected, and basically, that whole issue has been steamrolled by the pre-war era and then the Iraq War. And I think there are lots and lots of questions that need to be asked about 9/11 that haven't been asked.
We've got time on this show. What are some of the questions that ought to be asked that haven't been asked?
Well, one question that actually popped up while I was fact-checking some of the interviews that I did for this book was, I found out that, and I'd forgotten this, that 2 days after 9/11, there were several people that the FBI had identified as having been hijackers who came out and said, hey, you know, we're alive, we're not hijackers, we're law-abiding citizens, and this was reported in the international. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
3 years later, the 9/11 Commission report, which starts with an account of what happened on 9/11, uses the same names and refers to the same people as being on these airplanes. And one of the people, whose name escapes me right now, you know, they describe how he ran a knife across somebody's neck. I mean, you know, that raises serious questions in my mind. You know, I mean, does it raise questions in your mind, Bob?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
You know, and the questions that it raises beyond, you know, well, if it weren't these people, what people were on those planes? And, you know, then, you know, you have to say, well, what about the other people? I mean, the manifest, or all the lists, the passenger lists, you know, that have been put out there, and they're all over the internet. They don't have the names of the hijackers. So I mean, there are so many questions. And what happens is that a lot of people who are not professional investigators, who are not trained in proper reporting and investigative procedures, you know, get involved in looking into this stuff, and then it becomes this gigantic conspiracy soup, you know, and some very, very serious questions remain unanswered.
So, I mean, non-existent journalism or poor journalism promotes conspiracy theories because there's nothing.
Well, it leaves a vacuum for that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It leaves an information vacuum for that. And then, you know, pre-war, of course, again, there was this whole campaign to sell the war that is slowly, things are emerging. You know, the picture is emerging of this huge disinformation and manipulation campaign. And, you know, now, again, today, you know, the president comes out and says we're making progress in Iraq and so on and so forth. And, you know, if you talk to, I'm sure if you were to call Tom Lasseter, who's in this book, and he's a Knight Ridder war correspondent, I'm sure if you were to ask Peter Arnett, who's also in this book, and who lives in Baghdad, you might get a completely different and more factual view of what's really going on. And, you know, the other problem that you have is, I mean, just plain, certainly in television particularly, you have a lot of high-end journalists, high-profile journalists who are, the only way to put it really, to put it forthrightly, are corrupt. And, of course, unfortunately, Mr. Woodward is the most recent example of this, but Judith Miller, of course, and her pre-war reporting, I'm still agog as to why she didn't lose her job, you know, the minute it became clear that she hadn't done it. And that, you know, she was able to actually negotiate her departure from the New York Times. I don't understand why that happened. It makes me, you know, it raises big questions in my mind. Why does she have this stature, you know, at the New York Times?
Our guest today in Media Matters is Christina Borgeson, the editor of the new book, Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Out, just published in November by Prometheus Books and available, I hope, at fine bookstores everywhere. Borgeson has won an Emmy and a Murrow Award for her investigative reporting on CBS Reports. She has also worked with CNN and a variety of news media. She's an alumna of Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And her previous book, Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, won the National Press Club's Arthur Rouse Award for Press Criticism. I think it's fair to say that with this book, Christina Borgeson has joined the short list of journalists to do self-examination of the media industry. This book, Feet to the Fire, consists of 21 interviews, each comprising a chapter, that you do with a range of people involved in media, mostly journalists. How did you pick these 21 folks, Christina?
Well, first of all, as I said, I wanted to talk to people whose reporting I felt was most germane to the post-9/11 crisis era. And what I did was I broke the book down into five sections. Okay, I looked at the two arenas of power, you know, the media, you know, the top upper levels of media, and then I looked at people who actually covered, you know, the White House and its denizens. And then the core of the book, though, is a series of interviews with some of this nation's top national security and intelligence reporters, because that's where the rubber hit the road in terms of looking at the reasons for going to war and looking at whether or not they were legitimate. And what I did was every time I interviewed, and then I went on to there's history and context of our relationship with Iraq and then there's the war correspondence, which is another big section. But every time I interviewed somebody, I would ask them, well, who do you think did the best job of pre-war reporting, war reporting? So essentially, this is the people in this book are the best of the best. They're who the best people in journalism think did the best job. And that's why Knight Ritter, for example, is featured so prominently. And, you know, I want to make a point about Knight Ritter and about the whole, you know, system of mainstream journalism in this country. Knight Ritter has 11 million readers during the week and about 13.5 million during the weekend. They have a lot of readers.
What are some of their main newspapers for listeners who might not be familiar with the name Knight Ritter?
You know, the Philadelphia Inquirer, for example, is one of their papers. The Miami Herald is one of their papers. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they were doing some amazing reporting. Jonathan Landay, Warren Strobel, and John Walcott, their boss, the Washington bureau chief for Knight Ritter, were doing amazing reporting, pre-war reporting, asking tough questions about this. For example, about when the vice president was going around to the veterans group saying, you know, Saddam Hussein could, you know, reconstitute his nuclear arsenal and within 6 months, you know, they were not calling, they were not fact-checking with, you know, Cheney or Rice. They were fact-checking with mid-level intelligence analysts at the CIA because that's who they had access to. And they were fact-checking with people who were, you know, as Landay put it, working stiffs who really knew the issue of the Iraqis' nuclear capabilities. And Landay said, I mean, he called a guy right after he heard Cheney's speech to the veterans convention, and the guy just said to him, his source from inside the government just said to him flat out, the vice president is lying. And they started this whole, you know, really tough reporting because they were reporting. Their readers are the people who are parents, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, whatever, of people who are going to fight. So they really had a sense of mission about this. But the thing is their reporting didn't get any traction. And do you know why?
That's why you're on the show.
Because their reporting does not appear in the nation's two power centers, which is the political power center is Washington and the communications power center is New York. And because it did not get the attention of people in those two power centers and of obviously powerful people in those power centers, it just didn't get any traction whatsoever. And so that was an interesting thing that was going on. And in the power centers, what was going on in the papers, and again, Walter Pincus pointed this out, Pincus is reporting.
And Pincus writes for the Washington Post, we should
put it. Yes, and he's a national security and intelligence reporter. He's, you know, been covering intelligence for a million years. And, you know, he said what happened to him was his articles were going on page 17 of the Washington Post, asking the tough questions and reporting the tough stuff. Now, front page articles were not. So what happens in the arenas, in the power arenas, Washington and New York, is that the pro-war reporting, like Judith Miller, she was on page one, okay? The reporting they ask the questions is marginalized in the back pages of the paper. So that's how it's controlled, you know, within the power center, you know, in the power center papers. So, I mean, all this sort of came out as I was doing these interviews in this book. And it's really amazing when you read these interviews to see just how much these reporters already knew. I mean, Peter Arnett knew that the whole business of Iraq's nuclear arsenal was ridiculous. You know, he was talking about how Saddam Hussein hadn't even gone and done a tour of his military for years. The guy was completely defanged. He was barely interested in even ruling. I mean, he was working on a 52-part series for TV on his life and was building palaces, and his two sons were sort of fighting over the remains of the empire. I mean, there was nothing going on with Saddam Hussein. And as a matter of fact, of course, Rice and Powell basically said that on TV months before they started coming out with this campaign about, you know, Saddam's nuclear capabilities. So all these details are revealed through these interviews in this book, and it's pretty appalling.
Our guest today, Christina Borgeson, again on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about her brand new book, Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Out, just published this month by Prometheus Books. This is a series of 21 fairly extensive interviews with prominent journalists who've been covering U.S. politics for the last 5 years, especially international politics, the war on terror, and now the war invasion and occupation of Iraq. And as you put it, Christina Borgeson, you're talking to the people, for the most part, who've done the best work, so I guess they were glad to speak with you. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a few days before going on air on December 4th. So please don't call in. Sit back and relax. Enjoy the program. One of the points you mentioned, Christina, in this last chapter that Jonathan Landay, when you were interviewing him, who I believe is the son of one of our former broadcast journalism professors here, Jerry Landay.
Oh, really?
Legendary CBS correspondent. And one of the points you mentioned is the chapter is titled The Vice President is Lying. And
yep.
There was a recent article in the Columbia Journalism Review, not a year or two back, that made the point that in mainstream journalism, it is almost impossible for journalists to feel comfortable about saying something that bald. The president is lying. I mean, even when you've got the evidence that it's a blatant lie, there's something that goes on between the brain and the keyboard and the printed page or the news report that doesn't let you say the truth. I mean, is that something your journalists were talking about?
Well, Paul Krugman made a fascinating point on that issue.
And he was interviewed in the book, we should point out.
Yes. Paul Krugman is a columnist for the New York Times. And he basically said that there's a policy there where to say that the president is lying or the vice president is lying is considered a partisan statement, even if you can document that he's lying, okay? But you can say, so you can't say he's lying. You can say he misspoke, he misled, etc. But if you're talking about a private matter, like a consensual affair, if he's lying about that, okay, mm-hmm. You can say he's lying. But if he's lying about a public matter, like a policy or a rationale for war, it's unacceptably partisan to say that. That's what Paul Krugman told me.
And that seems to be, whether it's a formal policy in other media, that seems to be the effect in looking at the coverage. Because the amount of times you see someone that's the president or the vice president or someone lied, it's just almost non-existent.
Well, exactly. And the thing is that, well, and here's another point that I really want to make. I'll get back to that in a second. But there's another point that I really want to make, because when I spoke to people like Ted Koppel, and I spoke to the Associated Press's president and CEO, Tom Curley,
mm-hmm.
you know, one of the things that we have to be very clear on, okay, is that the big mainstream media operations are businesses, and of course you know this better than anybody. You've written and spoken extensively about this. But there is another factor in the equation, and that is the news consumer, or, you know, just the general population, the people who consume the product, the news product that's being put out. And the fact of the matter is, and there's no escaping it, okay, there's no escaping the fact that people would rather read People magazine and The Inquirer than, you know, read a serious, you know, dissertation on what's going on in Iraq and how, you know, the administration is, you know, where the administration is telling the truth and where the administration is not telling the truth, or where the Pentagon is telling the truth, or where the people, you know, and as Koppel said, you know, maybe, and he didn't say it as baldly as I'm saying it here, he said it very sort of diplomatically, but he said perhaps people will start taking more of an interest in these issues and in other countries around the world and what we're doing in other countries around the world, you know, when they experience more adverse consequences of these interactions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you know, if we had, you know, a 9/11, all of a sudden everybody was interested in Osama bin Laden, they were interested in the Middle East, et cetera, you know. But normally the American people really don't care what goes on beyond their borders. And this is a huge problem.
Going back to the last point, though, tying these two together, do you think that if the news media were less reticent about speaking out the truth and saying, oh, this guy's lying, maybe that would get people's attention? And they say, hey, this looks interesting. Maybe I ought to read this or listen to the story, rather than getting some sort of double speak that dances around the truth and never says it.
Well, here's the thing is, certainly I think television as a business, the news business in television is basically, it's obsolete, really. The way they report, even the formatting, the packaging, everything is completely obsolete. And of course, Nobody watches it anymore. It's all the same stuff on all the channels and so on. So I contend that yes, if somebody decided that the kind of reporting, you know, if somebody with big bucks decided, you know what, it's good business for me to, you know, put on television the kind of people like Landay and Strobel and their reporting, because people will really be interested in that. If you can show that there's a market for that, somebody, you know, somebody can turn it into a business. But the fact is now that the business paradigms that are controlling the news now, for a lot of reasons, as political reasons as well, okay,
mm-hmm.
are not interested in putting out that kind of information. But if you had, you know, some rich businessman with, you know, because, you know, these are companies that are owned by people with certain political, you know, leanings, obviously.
Okay. A lot of them are socialists, right? wait, no, I got that wrong. Oh, sorry.
But you understand what I'm saying? You know, if you know, the if somebody actually thought that this would, that this information would sell, you know, and they packaged it in a sort of more hip and new way. You know, I mean, I'd love to see Landay and Strobel, you know, packaged in some MTV style and put mm-hmm. out there. They would just blow everybody else away. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, that was my point. Basically, if you did really hard-hitting journalism, there might be people interested in it. I mean, you just don't know because they haven't really been exposed to much of it.
Well, that's exactly right. And somebody has to decide that it would be a good business to do. And I actually think it would be a good business to do. But, you know, I don't have, you know, it costs I think it's $200 million or $250 million to start a channel.
Let's see what the royalties look like for this Feet to the Fire, your new book, Christina Bordesen, and maybe you'll be the next Rupert Murdoch if we're lucky. Christina Bordesen, in the book, Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, two of your interviews early in the book are with Helen Thomas and Ron Suskind.
Yes.
And these are two very interesting interviews. Talk a little bit about each of those authors, why they're in the book, why you wanted to interview them, their stories, and what they had to say.
Well, you know, Helen Thomas, of course, is the grand dame of the White House press corps. I mean, this is a woman who has covered the White House since at least since Kennedy, you know. And so, in a sense, for the White House press corps, she's the tribe's memory.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about Helen, of course, is that she can, if anybody can talk about how things have changed for the better and for the worse, she's the one. And as everybody who listens to your show, you know, the pretty media savvy people, they probably know that she became sort of persona non grata with White House spokesman Ari Fleischer. Because you know, she kept asking him all these tough questions, and then eventually she asked the question about she asked why the president wanted to go to Iraq when, you know, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11 and you know, kill innocent women and children. You know, and she asked this question when Ari was talking about something had happened, I believe, in Gaza,
mm-hmm.
and something had happened in Israel where Palestinians had killed some Israelis or something, and the president was publicly deploring this via Ari Fleischer, the spokesman, and so that's when Helen stood up and said, "Well, if he deplores the, you know, loss of innocent lives, why does he want to go to Iraq and kill?" And boy, that was it. They wouldn't call on her anymore, and she was basically relegated to, you know, Siberia. You know, and this is, again, how this administration deals with reporters, one way that they deal with reporters who don't behave. And, you know, a lot of reporters respond to that by behaving, you know, because you want to have that soundbite. You know, you know the soundbite that's the answer to the question that you asked. So,
and one of the reporters who was getting answered when Helen Thomas wasn't was a gentleman named Jeff Gannon.
Yeah, and that's, you know, every time I talk to Paul Krugman, I don't know why, but he keeps saying, you know, I don't understand why there hasn't been more investigating into this Jeff Gannon thing. It's just so bizarre.
Yeah, why don't you give a little background on that for listeners who might not remember or be familiar with that story?
Well, Jeff Gannon was this guy who he was a male. Now, he had two websites, male gay porn websites.
Yeah, I think male escort is the polite term.
Male escort, yeah. Yeah. Does that mean he got paid for a service? I don't know, but he
I think that's a polite way to say, I don't know, man of the night. I don't know what the, you know, I don't want to get in a lawsuit here from our radio station.
Well, okay. So anyway, he was allowed access he basically became a member of the White House press corps. I mean, he was in and out of the White House. Is it the White House? Like, over 100 times?
Yeah, more than any other reporter by far.
More than any other reporter.
And he shot to the top of the White House press corps list, I mean, in the way George Bush shot to the top of that Air National Guard Reserve unit in Texas. I mean, just jumped ahead of everyone.
Exactly. So here, finally, is a guy who was, you know, during press conferences, would lob these you know, these wonderful softball questions and you know, questions that would allow for, you know, a scripted answer to be given as a member of the White House press corps. And, I mean, the fact that he had such extensive access to the White House and then was pretending to be this journalist, and it turned out he was, I forget what his, was it Talon News Service? It turned out to be some Republican operative.
That sounds right.
Funded operation. But here is this, you know, gay escort with two porn websites posing as a friendly journalist and having all this access to the White House, and nobody digs into it.
it's an amazing. So you have to wonder, had Bill Clinton had a similar situation, if it would have gotten a little more attention.
Well, that's the fascinating thing, and you have to say, you know, I mean, obviously, this group has a very well-disciplined communications machine that, again, includes this suppression, you know, information manipulation, disinformation, and suppression machine that is very, very efficient and effective. And of course, having said that, it raises big questions about, you know, what does that mean for this country and our democracy? You know, if everything we get out of the White House is basically packaged PR material, true or untrue, what does that mean, you know?
And I think the interview you did in the book right after the one with Helen Thomas with Ron Suskind of the Wall Street Journal really gets a lot at that issue as well.
Well, Ron Suskind, I mean, his interview really made the hair on the back of my neck go up, you know? Because this is a guy who, because he had access to certain key members of the White House, he did a thing. He did a piece on Rove, and he did a piece on Karen Hughes, and who was the White House communications officer, very, very close to Bush. And in a sense, by doing these psycho autobiographies of these people, He had a pretty good idea of, you know, what Bush was like, too, and what Cheney was like, and he sort of does these psychoanalyses of these people, and it's pretty frightening, particularly what he has to say about Bush and the whole policy-making machine, which is, you know, normally the way policy is made in the White House is the president will bring in experts on all sides of the issue to decide, to hash out what might be the best policy, and then they all, you know, come up with a report, present it to the president, and go back and forth with the president. And then it's like a, you know, it's an assembly of the best minds, okay? And then in the course of this process, too, the president reveals his mind and his, you know, intelligence in this exchange, and then policy is made that way. But in the case of this White House, policy is made. They don't care about what the experts have to say. You know, Rove handles some policy making decisions, and Cheney, of course, most famously or infamously, took care of energy and, you know, the war. So it's it's really kind of scary. I mean, it's just this tiny group of people. And, you know, Bush is a guy, as Suskind puts it, was a man who sat around many, many conference tables with nothing to offer. And that he's a very sort of primal guy. You know, he operates on his gut and his instinct. And he really doesn't care to process too much information. And, you know, I don't know. I think that's kind of a frightening thing for the head of state, head of the most powerful state on the planet.
How good of a job? I mean, Ron Suskind in his book on Paul O'Neill, the former Treasury Secretary in the first term of George W. Bush, or the first 2 years, really, the George W. Bush administration. I mean, how good of a job do you think, or does he think in the book, journalism has done of American journalism has done of conveying the nature of the Bush administration to the American people. So when they went to the polls to evaluate George W. Bush in November 2004, they had a sense of what they were voting for or against.
Oh, I think it's clear that I think it's clear that the press doesn't do a good job of that. You know, and I think it's clear from what they say that the press doesn't do a good job of that, and you know, that's for a number of reasons. It's first of all, you know, they're just plain daily housekeeping aspects of, you know, you've got to get things out, you got to get them out quickly, et cetera, that doesn't allow for real timely analysis and criticism. That possibly could be changed by having experts, on hand, at a moment's notice, but that's a separate issue. And I also think that, again, it's all about the PR machine. The press has not caught up with the PR machine. The PR machine is going 500 miles an hour. The press is going 50. And we really, really, really do need to have more reporters who are far more extensively trained, not only in the subject matter that they're going to cover, but they need to be, the critical analysis. These people need to be trained in critical analysis. They need to become more savvy about how they are being spun or disinformed or misinformed. They need to know a lot more about, how the government works and who the people are in government. I mean, there's a big education hole there, too. I mean, no longer in this very complicated world can you just have sort of, workman-type journalists covering the arena of power. It's just way, way too complicated and sophisticated and for that. We need far more cultured and educated people.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Christina Borgeson, the editor of the new book, Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, Top Journalists Speak Up, published by Prometheus Books. Just came out in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And hopefully it'll be available in bookstores all over the country and certainly in East Central Illinois. Christina Borgeson and I spoke a few days before going on air, so please don't try to call to sit back, relax, let us do the talking. Christina Borgeson is a noted journalist who's won both an Emmy and a Murrow Award for her investigative reporting and a graduate of Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. The book, Feet to the Fire, Christina Borgeson ends, the final section has six lengthy interviews with what you call the war correspondents, and it's really an all-star lineup, to put it mildly. Peter Arnett, John Alpert, Chris Hedges, Deborah Amos, Hannah Allam, Tom Lasseter. I'd like you to talk about why you concluded with them, and also, before you go to specific cases, or as you do it, to talk about what general themes emerged through all six of those interviews.
Well, I concluded with them because I think it's important. I thought it was very, very important for people to be aware of the consequences of our foreign policy, of this particular foreign policy decision, because it's we started with pre-war reporting and what happened there, and so now the war's on and what's going on with that. And it's also, again, as I say, I think it's very, very important for people to understand the consequences of American foreign policy in very stark terms. And this lineup of people are all known, as a matter of fact, virtually everybody in the book, I mean, there were no diplomats. Everybody really spoke their mind and said what they, wanted to say. And you get a very, very, very different sense of the Middle East and the Iraq War and what's going on with the war from these people than you do, from your average, your reading of the average newspaper. And that's because these people, I mean, Peter Arnett is basically the tribe's memory for the war correspondents, because he's been covering everything since Vietnam, and he lives over there in Baghdad, and he doesn't live in the green zone. These other people, they all like speak. Hedges is a brilliant guy and a very interesting guy because he's a very spiritual man, and I don't mean religious. I mean a very spiritual man. And he speaks Arabic and has done some amazing reporting. And Hannah Allam and Lasseter, they're Gen Xers. They're young. They speak the language. They get out there, and they really call it the way they see it. And that's rare with war reporting.
Let me interject just a second for our listeners' sake that these are correspondents who work with some of our leading media. They're some of the top correspondents in the world.
Yes, they really are. And again, I mean, they all these people were interviewed, last summer. And, you know, they all predict, you know, they were all saying, they were all, most of them were predicting sort of a civil war, you know, the business, and, you know, what do we have there? We basically have a civil war going on, you know. And, you know, they talk about the problems of the American troops, you know, who aren't given any language training, which by the way, the Brits were, and who, as a result of a series of serious missteps because of their ignorance with the culture of the culture and the language, etc., actually exponentially increased the violence and the rage against the American troops. You know, and these are young kids, you know, they're 19, 20, 21 years old, and to be sent out like that, you know, really not well prepared for dealing with this kind of war, because these wars now that we fight, it's not soldiers fighting soldiers. The people who really get killed in these wars now are the civilians, okay?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
the number of civilian dead, which, by the way, I think one of the worst things ever is that we don't even bother to count them. But anyway, also coming out of this book, which I think is one of the most profound things, is the fact that there was no consensus among all of these journalists, whether you were talking about war correspondents on the ground or, you know, all of these journalists, there were no consensus among them as to why we went to war. However, among those who have gone over to the Middle East and have been covering the Middle East, they report that there is a consensus among the Iraqis as to why we're there.
Mm-hmm. And
what
that
do you
is?
Suppose that is?
Does it have three letters?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's not Operation Iraqi Liberation either. Mm-hmm. It's oil. And yet oil, interestingly enough, is almost mentioned like in a sort of conspiracy way. You know, oh, that's the conspiracy view, oil.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but as I say, it's profound on a number of levels, to my mind, that these top messengers do not, among them, there is no consensus as to why we went to war. Because that tells you a whole lot about the pre-war situation.
What's interesting, too, is that as you read these six interviews, and really as you read the journalism of the best journalists covering the Iraq occupation and the current war going on there, it provides, I think, as you put it, a picture of a disastrous campaign, a stark failure at the policy level by the U.S. government. Yet the president still goes around saying it's a success. There's sort of a disconnect there. And there's not, I mean, I think the average consumer of our media would still not really quite see it as these correspondents think it is, they're writing it or as it's being presented by them.
Well, here's the interesting thing, okay? Also, there are other things with television. Tom Yellen, who's an ABC executive, was saying, you know, one of the problems with an ongoing war is after the initial, you know, going to war stuff, the asymmetric warfare that's going on now is not interesting to viewers, so it doesn't get covered, you know? And, again, you can't fault him as a journalist because he wants to cover it. You have to fault, you know, the business, okay? And because he's willing to cover it, is the way he puts it. But having said that, you have to make the comparison between Katrina, okay, the Katrina disaster and the Iraq War. What's interesting about the Katrina disaster is that all the big reporters could actually go down there and stand in the water and see the corpses float by and see what was going on in that you know, where they had all those people hanging out I can't remember the word, but anyway. And they could actually experience firsthand without getting their heads shot off what was going on. And people say the reporting was fabulous from there. Of course it was fabulous from there. And they could, you know, whatever the administration said, true or false, you know, the spin could not go very far because they were standing, the reporters were standing in the reality.
Yeah, also, the administration for several days didn't even have its spin together. It was caught flat-footed. So there was a spin-free zone for about 3 days.
Well, exactly. But the fact of the matter is, when you have the president saying, you know, you're doing a great job, Brownie, you know, to the FEMA director, who, again, you know, the level of corruption to a point, you know, to appoint a man with no disaster experience to this position, if it doesn't rise to the level of a crime because there are no laws on the books to address it, it is certainly in every other way a crime. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when the president says you're doing a good job, Brownie, and everybody's sitting there watching these corpses float by, the journal, they right there the disconnect is clear. The problem is you can't have that situation in Iraq. The reporters can't, it's so bad they can't go out on the streets and report what's going on. If they did, then there would have been, then you could actually say there was an amelioration of the situation, ironically, okay?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But the president can say anything he wants because nobody can get around in Iraq to report whether it's true or not.
It's just too dangerous for reporters to move around.
Exactly.
Now, Peter Arnett and some of the other journalists you interview in the book were in Vietnam or during the Vietnam era. How does the coverage of the Iraq War compare to the coverage of the Vietnam War from the perspective of the working journalist on the ground?
Well, first of all, there is one thing that remains the same, which is there's a pattern to all these things, which is in the beginning, the pre-war, when it's being sold, you know, all the reporting is positive, pretty much. It goes along with the program. And then when you get into the war, bang, bang, that's exciting. Again, going along with the program. And even if it's pretexts that are given for pre-war, by the way, which, of course, with Vietnam was the same thing, not perhaps as blatant as the Iraq War. But anyway, then you have the bang, bang. And then all of a sudden when you hit a critical mass of dead bodies,
mm-hmm.
that's when the public starts to change its mind. And again, the press here is not proactive but reactive, and the press reacts by becoming more critical and starts to ask the tough questions. So in that sense, everything's the same. You know,
mm-hmm.
history is repeating itself.
Yeah.
But what is different is every conflict, the government does something different to see how it can control information. Okay, the embedding thing was brilliant, actually. It was brilliant because it gave people footage. It gave, you know, there was stuff to cover. It was dramatic. And it didn't necessarily, you know, it didn't show the dead civilians. It didn't show the bombs that missed the troops and hit, you know, towns. You know what I'm saying? It
mm-hmm.
didn't show the human cost of the war. And still, the human cost of the war, for the most part, the American people are ignorant of it. So that part of the war is not being covered. But that is pretty much standard
yeah.
operating procedure. They realize they made a mistake during the, you know, during the Gulf War I because they really upset the press by just really putting the kibosh, you know, trying to censor everything. But the fact of the matter is there's a very, very, you know, a lot of sophisticated planning and organizing goes into controlling the media. And of course, with the Iraq War, though, I mean, some other more nefarious things have been going on, like, you know, this whole business that's just coming out about, you know, Bush talking about bombing.
You know, Christina Borgeson, I have to say, I'm going to have to stop us now. We're running out of time here on Media Matters. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today, talking about your new book, Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, just out by Prometheus Books. Thank you for being our guest. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 1 week.